surrounded by, as John mentioned, a number of rich people, and a kind of progressive version of the Heritage Foundation, since Heritage has been very effective in setting a conservative agenda. CAP's goal, when it was founded 6 or 7 years ago, was to push back on conservative views and to create a voice for progressives in Washington that was a little more aggressive than, say, the Brookings Institution or something, some of the traditional think tanks. I've been doing bioethics at CAP and some science policy for the last 6 years. And that's given me a somewhat unusual perch, an opportunity to develop ideas in a more overtly political context than most academics can, and especially to get to know how Washington works. I don't know if any of you have had internships in Washington. I encourage you to try to do that in your college career. It really is quite fascinating. Maybe like sausages, it's not something that small children should watch being made. It's pretty funky. It's a lot about positioning and, you know, who does what to whom. But it's also about ideas. And what has impressed me about my experience in Washington the last 6 years is how much government is driven by ideas, even though it's not obvious all the time. Even the funky stuff that is done politically is in the service of some idea. So it is very important for, I think, people like us, you know, to be engaged. Most recently, CAP sent 60-some-odd people to the Obama administration. They're now cycling back. So I've also had the opportunity to interact with people who are going into the administration and coming out again. It's kind of a Washington treadmill from the think tanks to administration and back. Of course, many people who leave the administration will go, like Peter Orszag, who's announced he's resigning there. He's going to go. He might go to a big bank, or he'd make a lot of money, or he might go to a think tank like American Progress. In that context, I've spent a lot of time in the last few years on the stem cell debate. So maybe I'll just say something about that. I'll say something about health reform, and I want to tell you something quite different. The stem cell issue is pretty quiescent right now. It's something you grew up with. It's quiet because the Obama administration has done what the president said he would do during the campaign, and by the way, what John McCain pretty much said he would do as well, which is make more stem cell lines available through the NIH for federal funding. Although there are, I don't know, 60 or 70 lines that have been approved as compared to the 21 lines that were approved under the Bush administration from 2001 to 2008, they didn't change that. There has been a bit of a surprise in terms of the bioethics. The NIH has found that when it looked at the consent forms for some of the embryonic stem cell lines, the forms were very specific about using your embryonic stem cells, the cells derived from your embryos if you were a donor, donor couple, using those cell lines for a specific disease or a specific disease research. And as a result of their review of these consent forms, the NIH has decided that that those cell lines can only be used for research in that disease. And that is not something that anybody anticipated. At least in people that I talk to, and I've been involved in this issue pretty deeply, people, I don't think, really anticipated that that could be the case. People thought that once the embryonic stem cell lines were approved for federal funding, that that would be the end of it, and that there wouldn't be these kinds of limitations based on consent forms. Now, it is possible, of course, in some cases, to go back to the donors and ask and reconsent them and say, well, now we'd like to use your cell lines for, you know, anything. But in some cases, it's not practically possible to do that. So that has proven to be a very interesting and, I think, unexpected obstacle. That's on the stem cell issue. We've not heard the last about related issues with regard to stem cells. But
why would they have done that?
It's pretty quiet.
Why would they have limited?
Doug Melton. One of the cases is Doug Melton at Harvard, who did this work deriving these lines probably 7 or 8 years ago, because he's been maybe more, because he's been interested in diabetes. What they were trying to do was the people like Doug were trying to work in good faith. You know, this is what you do, as you know better than I do, in clinical research. You tell people what you might be doing with them, right, or might be doing with their tissues, and what diseases you're working on. So they did that, without thinking, of course, 8 or 9 years later, that the result of that could be this kind of bottleneck. So it's an interesting, you know. So the NIH, and Francis Collins, the director, said last week, and this is a very difficult decision we had to make, because it means that some very valuable cell lines cannot be used in all the ways that science would like to. But we have this ethical problem. You know, we have to take these consent forms seriously, even though they were not well designed for this purpose. So, interesting. They're getting a lot of pushback. The Boston Globe is very annoyed at them, did an editorial a couple of days ago. But I think they, trust in science is one of the areas that I'm interested in as a historian of science, and I think they basically made the right decision, although it was very difficult. Another problem is that some of these consent forms, particularly from a group in Chicago, had what lawyers call exculpatory language in the forms, which is not supposed to be there, which means that if I sign up for, say, a clinical research study, there's not supposed to be a paragraph in there that says that I waive my right to sue you if something goes wrong. Right? That's called exculpatory language. The bioethicists have, the convention has been that you can't do that in a consent form, that it's wrong to do that. By the way, it might not protect you anyway in a legal case, but it shouldn't be in the forms. These consent forms from this group in Chicago that had a lot of very valuable embryonic stem cell lines had exculpatory language. So again, the NIH said, you know, we just can't fund those research with those lines because this is contrary to the conventions of bioethics. So that's where we are on the stem cell issue right now. There will be more issues. Some of you know that there's now this laboratory technique to make skin cells or so-called adult cells pluripotent, to make them behave very much like embryonic stem cells. I think there are very interesting new issues that I give lectures about on pluripotent stem cells. For example, if you can make what's called de-differentiate an adult cell and make it look like, function like an embryonic cell, you can turn that embryonic cell into any cell in the human body, potentially, by exposing it to the right set of genetic factors. Like you can turn these pluripotent cells into heart muscle cells, and they would be compatible with you because the DNA came from you, like a scrape from your cheek or something. But what if we could make an egg or a sperm from these de-differentiated cells? We have this big project on transgender. Well, you know, gender might not be relevant at all to reproduction if we can take these pluripotent cells. Now, there are big biological, obviously, obstacles to that. I wouldn't bet against the biologists, though. It's turned out in the last 30 years not to be a good idea to bet against them. Really clever. It might even be possible, some people think, to make a blastocyst, a cell from an embryo, an embryonic cell, and make an embryo from some de-differentiated cell. So the next time that you, you know, bite your nails or you slough off some cells, think that that cell could be a baby. Any cell in your body if this technology works. And I wouldn't bet against it. So very interesting ethical issues there. The general public is not even dimly aware. I mean, this is not even over the horizon. This is like, you know, the universe from what most people would be thinking of with respect to this technology. Second thing I'll talk about is very briefly, is health reform. The bioethics issues were not at all an issue in health reform except for death panels, in this distorted way, but you know, justice and our obligations to each other as people in a common community and nurturing the public space of decency in a modern society, none of that was part of it, as you know. It was all about how to finance it. Now we're going to get into some interesting areas because now they're writing the rules to implement the 1,800-page bill, which I can promise you almost nobody in Congress read, but that's pretty much what happens. There's probably no one person, in Washington, who has complete control, complete knowledge, and understanding of everything in the bill. But that's often the way things work. And as one of my former professors say, nobody in the world, no one person in the world knows how to make a pencil. You got to grow the wood, and how do you do that, and you know, how do you get it, and how do you get the lathes that get the wood from them, how do you get the lead, and you know, how do you make the machines that put the lead into the pencils and shape them, and then the eraser stuff? And, you know, no one person knows how to do a lot of things, actually, and no one person really knows what's in that bill. But now rules are being written to try to figure out what's in the bill, implementing rules. And those rules are going to involve questions like comparative research of different therapies, and they're going to involve the use of new ways of making databases to get information about health and so forth. So the implications of the bill are going to unroll in the next 5 or 10 years. They will have bioethical implications for the sake of privacy, and issues of rationing are going to come up inevitably. They have to. Nobody has the money to spend. Nobody in the world has the money to spend on everything that can be done, nor is everything that can be done for a patient necessarily in their interests. So all this stuff is going to be rich fodder for bioethics for indefinitely. So that's where we are on stem cells. That's my perception of where we are on health reform. Anybody have any questions or comments so far before I press on to something a little different? So one of the areas that I've been interested in for about the last 6 years or so, I guess now, and something that Sonia and I are actually working on this summer, is the ethics of neuroscience, especially in the context of national security. There's a very interesting, I think, complicated history of neuroscience in the context of national security and national intelligence. I wrote about it. I'm going to go to some slides here. I've written about this stuff in a book I published in 2006 called Mind Wars, about brain research and national defense. Some of you have heard me talk about some of this stuff, so I'm not going to say much about it, about the background right now. If you think about LSD experiments and brainwashing, you get the general idea of what I'm getting at here historically. So this is Frank Sinatra being brainwashed in a movie called The Manchurian Candidate, which was inspired by allegations of brainwashing during the Korean War of our POWs. He's being brainwashed here to be part of an assassination of a presidential candidate. These ideas have been around for a very long time. This has come up again in the context of interrogation. These are obviously detainees in Guantanamo. There are also detainees in what we used to call the War on Terror, sometimes called the Long War. I don't know what we call it anymore. But there are detainees in various places around the world, it seems, many of them in Central Europe. But we're most familiar with Guantanamo. What I've shown you on the right is a little image of a summary of basically interrogation techniques. This summary of interrogation techniques was developed by an Army social scientist in the late 50s, based on interviews with the POWs coming back from North Korea, our prisoners of war, who had signed so-called false confessions or made treasonous statements. People who'd been, in other words, quote unquote, brainwashed or interrogated, aggressively interrogated by the North Koreans and the Chinese. This list of interrogation techniques, which includes things like humiliation, without explicit reference to sexual humiliation, that was definitely like an Abu Ghraib. People have known about that for a long time. That's not new. This list of interrogation techniques was ironically used in Guantanamo to train interrogators to interrogate the detainees from the in 03, 04, 05. Senator Carl Levin actually released this document, which was classified, at a Senate hearing a couple of years ago to make this sort of ironic point that information from RPOWs was being re-engineered and used in interrogations with detainees in Guantanamo. So as you may know, President Obama said that enhanced interrogation, like waterboarding, which is now everybody knows about waterboarding, right? It's basically simulated drowning. President Obama signed an executive order in March of last year in which he said, we won't do that anymore. We're now going to go back to the international conventions, international views about what counts as acceptable interrogation. Now, those are still pretty intense techniques. They don't include nudity and sexual humiliation, but they do include things like maybe veiled threats against the family, not explicit. And they can include sleep deprivation, 24 hours, 48 hours, 96 hours. So it's pretty tough. But it does not include what many people would consider to be physical torture, but it does include very high-pressure psychological techniques. So the interrogations are, I was watching Morning Joe this morning, and Joe Scarborough, you know that show? And Joe Scarborough said, we're not doing interrogations anymore. That's news to me. Mm-hmm. My understanding is that there are still interrogations going on. We're not hearing about them. These are people who are being taken out of places like Pakistan and Afghanistan. Interrogations, I'm quite confident, are still going on, as they would, as they are every day in domestic policing. Psychologists, I'm sure, as they are in domestic policing, are still part of these interrogations. So I was asked by the FBI, by a group that was created by the FBI, called the High Value Detainee Interrogation Group, the HIG, to be part of a science advisory group to help them figure out, and here's the specific ethics issue right now, what are the research ethics behind doing research involving interrogation? Not torture, not tortuous interrogation anymore, but interrogation in general. What are the research ethics issues? So I agreed. This all started like about 6 or 8 weeks ago. I was asked to do this. So I agreed to do it. I agreed to be part of the group on the condition that nothing that I would be involved with in this advisory group would be classified. Now, I've had security clearances in the past, but I felt that in this environment, considering the nature of these issues, I didn't want to do anything that was classified. So what I'm telling you is also not classified. The FBI lawyers, I'm told, are now trying to figure out how they can satisfy my condition. I was also asked, somewhat independently, to go to talk to a group in Washington called the Intelligence Science Board. The Intelligence Science Board advises the intelligence community. There are 16 intelligence agencies. I know we just think of the CIA or the National Security, but all the uniformed services have intelligence agencies. Some have several of them, actually. So the Navy, Army, Air Force, they all have their own intelligence agencies. The Intelligence Science Board advises the intelligence community on science. They meet, usually they meet quarterly in Arlington at a Beltway Bandit called MITRE, which does a lot of DOD, Defense Department, and intelligence community advising and consulting on contract. A lot of government is contracted out, as you know, including a lot of this stuff. So there's a meeting next Wednesday of this ISB, and they invited me to come and talk about the ethics of behavioral research. It's the PowerPoint presentation I've got up right now, as a matter of fact. So I said I would do that, again, on the condition that it wasn't classified. So I'm told that there will be somewhere between 40 and 70 representatives of intelligence agencies at this all-day meeting, including for my talk. Some of them, and this the person who invited me actually said, some of them we won't know where they're from. Really fascinating. I love the dark side. So pressing on with the slides, I've written about the history in mind wars. I'm going to move this very quickly. Alan Dulles, CIA director, was very interested in hallucinogen studies coming out of the brainwashing era. Major psychologists like Henry Murray at Harvard were security, national security advisors, intelligence community advisors. We've forgotten about people like Murray, but he was maybe the most important living psychologist in the country, certainly with respect to national security issues. And he wrote the book on personality theory and psychology. He also helped to develop the TAT. Some of you have taken personality inventories for jobs or something. Maybe for the internship here, we should have given them to you. So he helped develop the TAT. By the way, the IQ test, you know when it was really elaborated? It was during the First World War on Army contract. So the IQ, the real elaboration and maturing of the IQ test also came out of the national security context, which I think is quite interesting. And then Ted Kaczynski, as it happens, the Unabomber, was in a research study, a humiliation study that was done by Henry Murray at Harvard in the late 50s. I'm not saying that Harvard turned Ted Kaczynski psychotic, but it is possible that Harvard does those things to people. Anybody from Harvard, by the way? There's a book about this called Harvard and the Unabomber. The author, Austin Chase, called me. He only figured out I was still around, where I was, who I was, by the end of the book, because the time he'd finished the book. And he was interested in me because my father was very close to Henry Murray. My father was a famous psychiatrist, and Henry Murray was one of his best friends. But neither I nor my mother knew anything about this, and I don't think my father did either. So that was kind of interesting. The person who did the LSD studies and other biological and chemical weapon studies in the CIA in the 50s was this guy, Sidney Gottlieb. He tried to get a poison cigar to Fidel Castro. Everybody who's tried to kill Fidel Castro is already dead, but Castro goes on and on and on. Just to give you an idea of how funky this was, this is a memo from Gottlieb to the bureaucracy in the CIA in 53, indicating, some of you can see it, this has to do with funding LSD experiments in the CIA in the 50s, $39,500 for LSD experiments. This was formerly a classified document. It's now unclassified. Frank Olson, some of you know about this guy, he fell to his death from a Manhattan hotel in 53 after being given LSD in an experiment at the Infectious Disease Institute at Camp Dietrich, now Fort Dietrich in Frederick, Maryland. I say descended to his death. Maybe he was psychotic and committed suicide, or maybe something else happened in that hotel room. There's a very interesting controversy about what really happened to Frank Olson. We do know that Harold Blauer, a tennis pro in New York, was in a mescaline study and unconsented in 53, right around the same time. And he died of an overdose of whatever it was they were giving to him. You can't die of an overdose of mescaline, I'm told, but you can die of an overdose of whatever is with the compound that they gave him. And that's what happened. All this was covered up until the late 70s. Some of you study research ethics, know about Henry Beecher, the great man of human research ethics in the U.S. He also was a CIA consultant on LSD. This was not known until after Beecher's death. He died in 75, just around the time that this CIA's LSD stuff was coming out. Many people in bioethics, I would say most people in bioethics, who teach Beecher all the time in their ethics classes, use his writings, don't know this about Beecher, and I think it's quite interesting. Back to the academics, Kurt Lewin, anybody take a social psychology course? Father of social psychology, also an OSS, then CIA advisor on psychological warfare, and even, for those of you who believe in ESP, the father of psychological operations, J.B. Rhine, distinguished Duke University professor. He tried to do controlled studies of ESP for many years. He was also a CIA advisor. And the CIA, I was very interested in psychokinesis and telekinesis. A lot of this stuff came out in 75. Senator Frank Church had his committee hearings. You can read about this. They actually drafted the FISA Act, the Foreign Intelligence Service Surveillance Act. The Bush administration got in trouble for trying to get around the act. You may remember that. But that all came out of the Church Committee. There are some people who believe, this journalist, for example, Vice President Cheney, for example, believe that the CIA was actually crippled, as this headline says, as this title says, by the CIA, the revelations of CIA activities that had happened in the 50s and 60s. That, in fact, some people will draw a straight line from the revelations of CIA activities in the mid-70s to 9/11. Because they say that this caused the CIA to pull back. Christopher Hitchens, the polemicist, the columnist, actually published his recent memoir, Hitch 22. I was reading it last week. He believes this was the case. A lot of people in Washington believe this, that the disclosure of the LSD experiments and other embarrassments the CIA caused them to pull back from the dark side, and that led them to be less effective in doing their counterintelligence operations. She has to leave for SAN, it's not me. Led them to be less effective. It's an interesting debate. Certainly Secretary Gates in the Pentagon is worried about this kind of thing. He's tried to recruit anthropologists to work for the Defense Department in places like Iraq. Because as you well know, our young soldiers are not familiar with the cultures that they're being thrust into. And there's a lot of journalism about how hard that is for them. And how much they've had to learn, and dealing with people in places like Iraq and Afghanistan. Unfortunately, two social scientists, have been killed when they were embedded with army units in Iraq. So this has caused pushback from the academic world. That's another topic we could pursue. So the program that the anthropologists have been involved with, in some cases, called the Human Terrain System. And this is something that that the Army and Secretary Gates in particular have been interested in advocating for. Back to psychokinesis. This is a passage from the National Research Council study in 1988 called Enhancing Human Performance. I'm going to read this to you just because I love reading it. I know you can read. This is so you can actually read this online. The claimed phenomenon applications presented by several multi-year offices range from the incredible to the outrageously incredible. The anti-missile time warp, for example, is somehow supposed to deflect attack from nuclear warheads so that they will transcend time and explode among the ancient dinosaurs. Time out. I don't know. I'm not an evolutionary biologist, but did they worry about, you know, what could happen to us? It's like the old science fiction stories, you know. One suggested application is a conception of the first Earth battalion made up of warrior monks, including the use of ESP, leaving their bodies at will, levitating, psychic healing, and walking through walls. Now, you'll be happy to know that 22 years ago, our predecessors in science thought that this was not, these were not programs worthy of pursuing. But I think it's fascinating that this was taken so seriously as late as the late 80s. I have spoken to people who believe that there are some pockets in the intelligence world that are still interested in these things. So I wouldn't rule out the possibility that your tax dollars or your parents' tax dollars are still supporting these kinds of programs. I wouldn't rule out the possibility. Some of you might have seen The Men Who Stare at Goats, which was based on this this document. It was a book first by a Brit, then a film. I was all excited when I saw the trailer. I thought it looked really good. Unfortunately, the trailer is better than the movie. See the movie?
Yeah.
They didn't know what to do with it, really, right? And George Clooney's an interesting guy. He obviously was really into the project, but even he couldn't save the movie. But anyway, it is part of our culture. So, you know, there's more stuff coming down the pike for possible interrogation, detection of deception through brain imaging. There's new devices like transcranial and magnetic stimulation. Some people think could improve learning and memory, influence people when they're in high pressure situations. The Army through DOD, I should say, through its science agency, DARPA, has invested in this kind of thing, invested in what's called the HeadWeb project. The idea is to put have a cap that could actually read what's going on in your brain and transmit that information to monitors far away. Perhaps they could also stimulate your brain through electrical impulses that could help you to deregulate your stress, or downregulate your stress, for example, or something like that. Lots of speculation about how this might work in neuroscience, neurotechnology. Some of you are familiar with monkey mind power, moving robotic arms. This is now being done with people. It's not a challenge anymore. Many labs know how to do this. So we're moving into some really funky stuff. Here's the Roborat. The Roborat was a project at Downstate Medical School where I used to teach, basically controlling a rat with a few pushes of buttons on a laptop like this. You could maybe send the rat in to bite Castro and give him something nasty. Yeah, who knows? Entirely possible. Some debate about whether you could use pills like beta blockers to prevent post-traumatic stress disorder. Would you produce guilt-free soldiers if you did that before sending them to combat? Beta blockers probably could not work right now to do this, but there are people who believe that something could be developed that could do this. Back to interrogation. I'm going to end with this. I might go on with a couple of slides. The trust drug, oxytocin, that's a question. You and I are making oxytocin all the time in our brains. It does lots of things. One of the things it is it's associated with trust. And there are some studies, including by a guy at Claremont Graduate University named Paul Zak. You can read his stuff online, Z-A-K. He's done studies that indicate that in competitive situations, like bargaining games that he does with his students, if he gives them a whiff of oxytocin, it makes them more trusting. This is sometimes called the trust drug. Now, there are people who don't believe that this stuff can get past the blood-brain barrier when it's introduced through the nose, but there are these studies that suggest that it might work. Interesting question for interrogation ethics. Would it be ethical to give people something like oxytocin before they're interrogated? Now, this could be an interesting question for domestic policing, as well, of course, in the detainee, interrogation situation. Or as good bioethics students, would you consider this to be, even in some ways, even worse than torture? Because you're actually taking over a human personality. You know, you're really invading privacy when you're deciding for somebody else who they should trust. It seems to be something we take pretty seriously. I've also pointed out to my students a couple of years ago, my undergrads here, that this has amazing dating possibilities. You could slip this into somebody's drink at the beginning of the evening. You may change the whole course of the date. They found that pretty creepy. that's my job, apparently. Not long after I said that, a couple of students pointed out to me that there are actually websites that talk about this. Right? Have you seen any of those? So don't admit it if you have, right? Too late.
It was brought up in my biology.
Yeah, yeah. It was brought up in biology?
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
In physiology.
Yeah. So, you know, maybe this stuff, maybe the studies so far are wrong, but even if they're wrong, people are getting the idea of the basic mechanisms that might enable you to develop products to do this kind of thing. So that obviously raises huge issues in a lot of contexts. Before you have a job interview, for example, you know, in 20 years, will somebody be giving you a dose of something like oxytocin? Who knows? Just to give you an idea of how the research community is very interested in these things, the intelligence community is very interested. This is a project I was part of a couple of years ago, basically on how neuroscience is going to work in national intelligence over the next 20 years. This was the charge we got from the sponsor, which was, as you saw, the Defense Intelligence Agency. So I'm not making this up. They're serious people who are interested in these things in the intelligence world. You can read this report online, by the way. This is one that was done right around the same time as ours. I was not part of this one. Again, you can read this online. This is Army Opportunities in Neuroscience. So the idea is using biosensors and something like transcranial stimulation, maybe to wake up a soldier, maybe to help them learn, help their memory. This is real stuff. This is another project I was involved with at the National Academies, the National Research Council last year. This image is a portable handheld lie detector. It's junk, and it's being used in Baghdad right now. It's being used as one of the ways that potential locals are screened, potential employees who are local to Iraq are screened for employment in the Green Zone, which is where our embassy is. Now, apparently it's not the only way people are screened, but they're screened using this really, it's based on the same junk technology, junk science, as the lie detector that is used now. Lie detectors are used a lot, but they're really only useful to intimidate people. They don't seem to have very much reliability when it comes to really telling whether you're lying or not. But the intelligence community wants to push out devices because their job is to protect us. The scientists and engineers want to validate those devices, but the intelligence community people say that takes too long. You don't really understand our problems. You know, we face these threats every day. You're in the ivory tower, and you want to validate things. Well, that's fine. That's lovely, but we need stuff. There's some examples of what's going on here. I'm going to just end to see if I can find it. Some of you may know that a few weeks ago, Physicians for Human Rights released a report on alleging that human experiments had been done in Guantanamo during the War on Terror. Anybody see that? There was a piece in the New York Times about this. So this report alleges, completely based on already public literature, basically memoranda that came out of the Bush administration's legal counsel office, that there were systematic human experiments going on in Guantanamo. Now, what they're talking about is things like modifying waterboarding techniques to protect the people who are being interrogated from irreversible harm. So, for example, and this is the example that they use in this report, which you can read, it's online. There was good evidence that if you waterboarded somebody a lot using fresh water, that they would become what's called hyponatremic, that they could become comatose and they could die. So instead of using fresh water, and some of these people, by the way, who were waterboarded dozens of times, some over, one guy, over 160, 180 times. Very inefficient way to interrogate somebody. And so instead of using fresh water for these modified, these simulated drownings, they used saline. Okay. Now, systematically altering the way that you do an interrogation could be regarded as a form of experiment. Or it could be regarded as quality assurance. Okay. Now, the authors of this report regard it as an experiment. The CIA, when it was responding to this report a couple of weeks ago, said, we didn't do experiments. Now, what the CIA spokesperson didn't go on to say was that this was a quality assurance for torture. Right? But that's, I think, really what it was. Why were they doing that? They wanted to make sure that if there were investigations after the Bush administration of what happened in Guantanamo, that the interrogators would not be at risk of being accused of causing permanent physical harm to the subjects of interrogation. Right? So they wanted to ensure the quote-unquote safety, the well-being of the people who were being interrogated by altering interrogation techniques. So PHR claims that the Bush administration kind of itself got itself into a logical, they painted themselves into a logical corner. They had to do unconsented, I would say unethical, human experiments, or at least unethical program evaluation, in the context of torture, in order to protect the people who were doing the interrogations from being accused of hurting these people in some future investigation. You can read the report, you can draw your own conclusions. But the fact that this report just came out a few weeks ago has, I think it's fair to say, stimulated interest in the intelligence community about what the appropriate limits are for doing research on interrogation. And that's part of what colors the environment for the talk that I'm going to give to them next week. So I'm going to end there and see if you have any comments or questions. Yeah?
And that PHR report only addressed, or only alleged that the only human experimentation going on was the waterboarding? It wasn't, anything medical?
I will tell you that my expectation before they released the report, and I had been involved in a few conversations about it before they released it, my expectation was that they were going to allude to something like oxytocin or to other drugs. They didn't,
right,
which suggests to me that they didn't really get the whistleblowers that they had hoped to get. Jim Rosen, who wrote the New York Times piece, it was Monday about 3 weeks ago, and that I helped him with, in which he describes this report just after it was released. Rosen believes that there is more going on, and that as a reporter, he's going to try to find out. Chris Hitchens says, I became a journalist so I would actually be able to get accurate information. Since you can't necessarily get it from journalists, you have to become a journalist to get accurate information. Rosen is going to try to pursue this. So there may be more to come out, but this is very difficult because the people who are the potential whistleblowers could subject themselves to prosecution. If they talk to a journalist about this and it was classified information, then they could be viewed as in violation of the National Security Act and go away for a very long time.
Of course, WikiLeaks and things like that make it a little easier.
Yes, so if you could, you know what WikiLeaks is. Right, they've been putting up on the web these images of the videos of these aerial images of people being taken out in places like Baghdad in combat, including two Reuters photographers who were killed. You can actually watch them being killed. So anyway, WikiLeaks. I mean, obviously the new technologies. This stuff is changing what might be done. Obviously, the photographs of Abu Ghraib, right? which was so easy to take. You know, those images were because of the new technology. I don't know that there's anybody, taking you know, videos of what was going on in Guantanamo in 2005. But you're right. I mean, if you know, if stuff like that becomes available, then it could change everything. But I wouldn't want to necessarily. I wouldn't encourage anybody I cared about to get involved in releasing that kind of information unless they were in a place far, far away from here already. Yeah.
So, what are your thoughts on like the research ethics of like, I guess, national sense of national security things they're going to be discussing?
Yeah. So, actually, it turns out I realize I don't have the precise PowerPoint presentation that I sent to them last week. I used to before I used Dropbox, but I would often just bring a memory key and and plug it into the laptop. Well, you can't bring a memory key in. They don't want anything to screw up their machines in places like MITRE. They're classified information on them, and they don't want any classified information to drip into my memory key from their laptops or their computers. So I had to send them my PowerPoint presentation in advance. But it's not classified. I mean, I could put it up, I'll probably put it up on Dropbox. So what I'm going to say is that you have to follow the international conventions, which means if you're going to call it research, and that's a whole other topic I didn't get into. Well, I got into a little bit. If it's not quality assurance, or if it's not program evaluation, or it's not assessment, if it's really an experiment, in a red-blooded research sense, then you have to get informed consent. And you have to have prior review of a research protocol. End of story. The federal regulations require the CIA to have an IRB, a research ethics board, to do prior review of a protocol and to get informed consent from research subjects. Period. Now, a legitimate IRB would never approve a research study that involved useless pain. Would never do that. And the CIA has an IRB that has members who have security clearances. It's supposed to include at least one person under federal rules who is not a part of the agency, who has also got the appropriate security clearance. Interesting question, which I have been wrestling with for many years, is what if you were, let's say we called you up, you're going to be the ethicist on the CIA IRB, and we're going to give you a top secret clearance, or whatever we call it, to consider this research study. By the way, the CIA says it doesn't have any secret human research studies at this point. Okay, but let's say they want to do one. You're on the committee. You read the protocol. It's 5-1 against you. Okay, you say it's wrong. You shouldn't be doing this. What do you do? Now, if you're on a regular IRB, let's say you're the community representative on a Penn IRB, you could go to the Inquirer. They'd be happy to have a story about that, embarrass Penn. You could go to the dean. You could go to the president of the university. You could come to the bioethics center. Right? If it's a classified study, it's not clear what you can do if you dissent and you're on the IRB. You would probably have to go find somebody in the White House who has the appropriate clearance, which is another problem because they don't all have the right clearance, even if they're on the White House staff. Who would listen to you, right, and take it to the top? So that's a problem. But the general answer I'm going to give them is straightforward, and you guys already know it as bioethics students. You got to follow the rules, you got to get prior review, and you got to get informed consent. Sir,
don't you think anybody who becomes a member of the panel should consider that before you become a member of the panel?
They should.
You know, if you're going to work for the government, that you're going to be facing that issue.
Yeah.
In the end.
Well, technically speaking, of course, if you're the civilian member of an IRB in a classified setting, you're not an agency member. You're not an employee, right? So you have this kind of an ambiguous relationship. Are you an agent of, or are you a monitor of their activity? Right? But yes, you should know that. I guess informed consent, for everybody in that security cleared IRB would be a good idea. But I will, I can tell you that this is not something that's been carefully considered. When I worked for President Clinton's Radiation Interference Advisory Committee, we recommended that anybody in this position that I've just described should be able to, it should be a clear path to the White House, and that should be in regulation, but that really is not yet in regulation. So it's, you're right, somebody should be sophisticated enough about the system. But, you know, on the other hand, some pointy-headed bioethics professor might be invited to do something like that and think, oh my God, that is really cool. I'm going to do that and not, you know, and not give it some thought about what the implications could be if they disagree with the majority of the committee on a protocol. So it's it ought to be the case, but it ain't. Yeah.
You talked about the distinction between quality assurance and research in these, I don't know, interrogation methods.
Yeah.
Do you think that's primarily a functional distinction, or is there really like some ethics behind?
Well, the distinction is supposed to be that research, this is in the federal regulations on human research, research is supposed to generate what's called generalizable knowledge, whereas a program evaluation is really only supposed to be about the case at hand. Right? So let's imagine that you're an industrial psychologist and you want to figure out how to get the factory to work better. If the information that you're gathering, however you do it, through surveys of the workers or observing the workers or, you know, whatever it is, if that information is only being used to improve the functioning of that business or that factory, it's program evaluation. But if you, for example, then go to a management journal and publish your experience, now if you get into publication, you're moving the direction of generalizable knowledge because you're implying that this is something other people could learn from as well. Or if you're comparing your experience as a consultant in this factory to your experience as a consultant in another factory, that begins to look like a controlled study, begins to look like research. So it's sort of a functional, I guess, distinction, but it's pretty substantive. Now, if you talk to professors of business who do this kind of work, psychologists who work in industrial, you know, management, the best ones, in my experience, will go to an IRB in any case, because they do not want questions to be raised about whether it's research or not. You know? But in principle, you can do, I mean, this has come up with journalists and historians, you know, who've gone to interview living people. Are they doing research in the sense of generalizable knowledge, or is it limited to this particular case, right? So if I'm a journalist, for example, and this is something that people have worried about. So far, it's kind of in abeyance, but people are worried about this. If I'm a journalist, now I'm going to go interview Henry Kissinger. Right. Do I have to give him a consent form? Is he a research subject? I'm learning some. Let's say I'm interviewing him about the decisions he made at the end of the Vietnam War. Right. I'm a historian. Okay? And I want to learn how people in those positions, he was the National Security Advisor to President Nixon, how do people in those positions make decisions that involve life and death? Well, at what point am I engaging in generalizing from my interview data with him, and at what, or am I just talking about him? It's very difficult. So far, IRBs have not insisted that everybody who's getting an MA in history at a place like Penn, who may be, you know, interviewing an interesting person, has to go through an IRB. Right. So far, they have not required that. But there's been talk about that, and there's been talk about it for journalists, and it scares the hell out of them. Now, of course, if you're not getting a degree at a research university that gets federal support, or if you don't have an NIH grant, you're not really obliged to get informed consent. Right? It's all tied to funding. Funding source. You can go home to your. I always say this to my students. You can go home to this afternoon, get some whatever you want, LSD or whatever it is. Get the neighbor kid, you know, give him a dose as an experiment, you know, to observe the effects. And you would not be in violation of federal regulations because you're not funded by the NIH to do that garage experiment with the neighbor kid. You have serious legal liability, right? But it's not because of the federal rules on research. It's all tied to funding. So, yeah. But it would probably be a mistake to do that. It would, and even if you're a research psychologist being paid by the factory, that scenario I mentioned before, you're not being paid by the NIH, you're not a grant or anything. In the factory, the company isn't getting federal funds. The convention is that you go through an IRB because there is tort liability. What if you learn some things about the factory workers in the course of doing your evaluation, about their drug use, for example? That gets into your documents. That's discovered by somebody. You know, they lose their job because the boss sees that they've been using drugs. That's why they suck at their work. They sue you. Why? Because you were doing an unconsented research study. So any smart behavioral psychologist, any management expert, will get IRB review now. But technically, they may not need to.
All right. Well, I think we can stay in the room for a couple more minutes, but I just wanted to stop here for those of you who have to run, and publicly thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Research interests besides water.